Hello, listeners. Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. My name is Maciek Makulski. This is episode 121 of the podcast, and I am joined today for this episode by one of our other co-hosts, Adam Reichardt. Hello, Adam. How are you? How was your night after historic Poland's victory in the World Cup in Qatar?
Hi, Maciek. Hello, listeners. It was actually, as we are recording this on December 1st, a historic victory through a loss, which was quite interesting. But I have to say, you know, just for a brief conversation, if we're going to start with World Cup discussions, that the Polish goalie, Wojciech Szczęsny, was quite amazing in this World Cup. I think no goalie has ever defended two penalty kicks in the World Cup. So that's quite an important success. And Poland, I think since, I don't know, since 1980-something, 1986 maybe,
1986,
is getting out of its group and going to the next phase of the tournament. So this is... this is quite an important time for Poland, let's say.
Yeah, and that was really thin margin because the goal difference between Poland and Mexico was just one goal. Yeah, and this one goal was so decisive, and I think that, you know, this footballer from Saudi Arabia who scored against Mexico in the second half will be a national hero in Poland shortly. And regarding Wojciech Szczęsny, I saw that someone on Twitter proposed that he should become a new Polish Minister of Defense.
I also read a proposal that he could be part of the air defense system for Warsaw. So he's good at intercepting... incoming.
A lot of new functions for him quite soon, I think. And so it was quite maybe funny way to start this episode. Before we go into the main part, I just want to say that Adam, yours and Aga's forecast from the last week episode, in which you were expecting me to get cold after you and Aga.
That's right, yeah.
At least for now, it did not materialize because I'm here, fit and healthy. So let's see what happens next. And now, really seriously, we have an important topic today to discuss.
Yes.
Actually, Aga did very good interview. And Adam, maybe you can say a few words about our guest and the main topic of the conversation.
Yes. So this discussion between Agnieszka, our third co-host, as most of you know, she sat down with Francis Farrell, who is a reporter and journalist. He is with the Kyiv Independent. And they talk about, I think, what is probably the most important situation right now when it comes to the war in Ukraine, and that is the attacks on the infrastructure. Francis gives us some insight on what life is like under these very difficult times. But he also talks about his visit to Kherson after the liberation and the experience there, which I think, as our listeners will find out, was a very powerful one. And this liberation of Kherson in general, Maciek, I think, is really probably one of the most important moments in the most recent weeks, the most important part of this counteroffensive that we have been seeing since September. And now the question, I think, is what will happen next as the winter starts to really set in. So we have a great interview with Francis on his reporting and his experiences. And Maciek, I do want to mention that there's in the next several days for our listeners to stay tuned, that we will have also a special episode about Ukraine, which is part of our special coverage. So we tried to divide these two episodes up. I sat down with Anton Nejchuk from Kyiv, and he talks about the military strategy and the current strategy of Ukraine, the current strategy of Russia, and what he thinks is next. So I do want also to just put that out there and tell listeners to stay tuned after this. It will complement this interview very well.
Also, Agnieszka recorded a special episode with Promote Ukraine, which is a Brussels-based NGO which is helping Ukraine and Ukrainians. So there is new content for our patrons, which we really like always. And Adam, regarding the topic, I can't agree more with what you said about the importance and significance of the liberation of Kherson. I hope that's enough for the intro before the interview, and now it's probably a very good time to go into the interview with Francis.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Talk Eastern Europe. This is Aga speaking, and with me is our guest for this week, Francis Farrell. Francis, welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Hi, Aga. Very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. This is for you, dear listeners. An information for you is that this is our second take at this interview because we tried to record it yesterday, but Francis yesterday was in Odessa. We are recording this on the 25th of November. Yesterday, there was zero signal in Odessa, unfortunately, following another mass attack on the energy infrastructure by Russia. So we are trying it now again, and hopefully this is going to work. But so thank you so much, Francis, for taking the time. And I know that it's not very easy right now to even do a simple call like this from Ukraine. So I'm just going to jump straight into my questions because we don't know how much time we have. I usually do a little introduction to the guest in the intro to every episode. But honestly, in this case, I actually want you to introduce yourself because I think a lot of our listeners might be wondering, how does an Aussie become essentially a frontline wartime reporter in Ukraine working for Kyiv Independent?
Right. Well, I guess that's a little bit of the intro that you've done for me. That's basically it. My name is Francis. I am from Sydney in Australia, from quite a long way away from where I am now. But I've lived in and studied in Europe for 7 years now, and also went down this like university specialty line of Russian post-Soviet studies, politics. I was just finishing a master's actually, when I could feel that the war was beginning to start, and I just came to Ukraine a week before the 24th of February, and yeah, I'd already done a bit of journalism, a bit of writing before that, especially through our beloved project Lossy 36, where I was managing editor for a few years.
Yay, go Lossy 36.
and that was a huge help to just get me used to writing. And yeah, with this job, I was just in the right place at the right time. I said, I'm here, I've got an accreditation, I'd like to work for you, native English speaker, but I do speak Russian and Ukrainian as well. And they were like, okay, yeah, give it a go. And like, yeah, from in the space of just a few months, I went from a student to a journalist, and then when the time came, I said, I want to go here, I want to go to Donbass, I want to go to Kherson, and they said okay, and then I went. So yeah, quite a whirlwind, but there's really nowhere else I'd rather be at the moment.
That's really amazing. And yeah, you mentioned Kherson. I know that you were there basically right after the liberation of the city, and you were there also when President Zelensky came, also just a few days after the city was liberated. I know that probably, well, myself and a lot of our listeners, we've seen these different videos, films, everything, pictures of people celebrating the liberation, but I was wondering, what was it like to really be there? What did you observe when you were looking at everybody around, not just, let's say, one person in the video, but like, what was the mood in the city?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, and I wasn't even there in the very first days. Obviously, there was just one or two very sneaky journalists who managed to make it through, and I think they had their accreditations pulled because of that. But even on the third day, that's, you know, people have had 3 days, three nights to get over this liberation. They're still coming out, they're just walking the streets of their city where they, you know, felt really unsafe to walk for 8 months, walking the streets with their flags, still just hugging each other, hugging soldiers, you know, chanting glory to Ukraine, singing the anthem, at every possible opportunity. It really is not something that you can just describe in words. I would say that just being there was an even stronger experience than many of the videos that went viral. It was just such a sincere and such a widespread kind of mass episode of pure joy that I'd obviously never seen in my life, and I might not ever see again, to be honest, until victory comes, I would say, or a certain person dies. It was a really, really special few days. And then I came back, you know, several days after, and then stayed for a few days. And obviously it fades after a while. It's not quite as intense as in the first days, but just talking to people, like, how are you feeling? And it doesn't matter. They don't have water. They don't have electricity. They're starting to be shelled. They're still just, like, compared to a couple of weeks ago, still under Russia, just so, so happy.
Yeah, speaking of these difficult conditions, which the inhabitants of Kherson are still experiencing, a lot of other cities in Ukraine, and not just cities, but a lot of people in Ukraine are now experiencing similar difficulties, right? So problems with electricity, with connection, internet connection, phone connection, with even things like running water, heating, of course. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering, how do people cope now on an everyday basis? I mean, for you listeners, we had a very brief chat with a video on with you, Francis, and you're sitting in the dark, right? And basically this is the reality for so many people. And winter has basically come already to Ukraine. So I'm wondering how do people cope, more or less?
Yeah, personally, I'm in a pretty privileged position in the sense that I live in the center of Kyiv on the first floor. Honestly, I really don't know what it's, I can't imagine what it's like for maybe older people, people with mobility issues who are living on, you know, the 17th floor or something in an old apartment building, where if they lose power, they lose the elevator, but more importantly, they lose water as well, because the pumps that pump the water up to their apartments are also powered by electricity. And so for me, just in comparison to that, I'm totally fine. You know, I will just walk in and out of my house, and I can find a trendy cafe with a generator, you know, soon enough. But it is getting tougher for everyone, I would say. I think the first few weeks, especially at least in Kyiv, I don't know what to compare it to. I mean, Odessa didn't really have blackouts until the last week or so. And then in Kyiv, you had this, you know, these scheduled blackouts where you could have a look on the internet when you would have power and when you wouldn't. But in the last few days, the last wave, especially of missile attacks, has really seemed to have been a much stronger blow. I'm not sure why, because it's a similar amount of missiles that were shot down by the air defense, but I guess still there are some that make it to their targets. And yeah, when you have a whole day, a day and a half, where there's no electricity, sometimes in many places, as I said, there's no water. And yeah, worst of all, there's no connection. And then that's when you, and it's getting colder and it's getting snowy. That's when you start to feel like, oof, we are in for a difficult winter, for sure. And this is just the beginning. I read a tweet about this yesterday, and it made me think about it a lot. Like, it's kind of crazy how this whole blackout situation is just so normalized at the moment, like in discourse and kind of public discussion about the war. Like, it's just, oh, Ukraine's fighting Russia. Russia's being, a kind of tricky, nasty actor as usual, and it's targeting infrastructure. And so Ukrainians are sitting without electricity. But like, it makes you think, hold on, like, that is not a normal thing in a war between two, you know, post-industrial huge countries. It's not something we've seen at all since forever, basically. So just that targeted knocking out of basic utilities It's pure, it's pure terrorism. It's a war crime. But at this point, it's just like, yeah, that's the way this war is being fought. And European leaders and people are not really making too much of a special reaction to it, apart from maybe some new air defense systems pledged, which we're very grateful for. But it is quite strange when you think about it, because when you are here and you realize the winter that's coming up, you're like, wow.
That's very true.
Yeah, it's not fun and game.
That's very true. I wonder if it's a matter of when you see in the news that there was a strike and 20 people were killed, you feel that it affects you more emotionally than the fact, for example, that millions are without electricity, because you're thinking, well, at least they're alive, you know. But that's not the right logic. That's not the right way to think about it, because, yeah, if they don't have electricity, they don't have heating. If they don't have heating, they will freeze, and different people might have, you know, different reactions to it. There's a lot of different health conditions that will be aggravated by this. And you simply cannot survive in the long term without water, without electricity, without heating and all that, especially in winter conditions these days. So I think that's very true. And I think this needs to be put a bit more back on the agenda. And people need to realize how difficult living in such conditions is. I mean, sometimes, you know, it happens also, let's say, somewhere else in Europe, that you have a blackout in one building, right? Or one flat. And I mean, you know, let's say it happened a couple of times to somebody in my family, and it's such a huge thing, you know. You don't have electricity for 3 hours, and everybody is like, oh my God, we have no electricity. What do we do? And there, people don't have it for, like you said, you know, hours upon hours, or even a day or 2 days. And I think the more strikes there will be, the weaker the whole grid will be, right? So even though, obviously, the Ukrainian authorities are trying to fix it, and they manage normally to fix it after some period of time, probably the system as a whole is becoming weaker and weaker and more vulnerable.
Of course, yeah.
To new damages.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing I would add about that is that this is coming, you know, the same time that, you know, it comes in waves, this discussion about negotiations, about peace negotiations, about when will, you know, when will Ukraine be ready to negotiate? Do they want to negotiate? And now that Russia is losing on the battlefield more and more, they're really starting to push this this public line about, you know, the Ukrainians, they don't want to negotiate. Russia is encouraging peace negotiations, but the Ukrainians, they just want more war. And it's just like, what kind of a ridiculous, like, cynical and absurd statement to make when there is just mass terror attacks like this. And I think it was Lukashenko yesterday at the CSTO summit saying that, you know, Ukraine needs to enter peace negotiations, otherwise they will just be annihilated or something like that. It will be the end of Ukraine. And you think, like, why on earth is this discussion about whether Ukraine wants to negotiate or not? Like, we have and finally, Europeans and NATO are starting to recognize what it is. We have a terrorist state at work here. You know, there's no, Russia's not even pretending to, you know, that Ukrainians like them anymore. You know, that they're ruled by some kind of Nazi junta. Russia understands that the whole country is against them now, and just wants to bury them in darkness and cold. Yeah, crazy times, basically. Yeah.
My gosh. Well, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I hope that the world will start reacting to this, because, yeah, in the long term, it just cannot go on like this. But let's try, and I want to sort of move a bit more to your, you know, I would love to just sit here and chat with you, but I think what probably our listeners would also love to hear is a bit more of your experiences as a journalist and what you've seen and where you went. So I know that you went to, and you mentioned that as well, you went to a lot of frontline areas, or so liberated areas. And when we spoke a couple of days ago, you told me that front lines and liberated areas are not necessarily the same thing. And I thought that was quite interesting, and I kind of agree, but I wanted you to maybe elaborate a bit more on, mm-hmm. on what you mean by this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a big overlap between the two. Obviously, Kherson now is a good example of that, now that it has been liberated after 8 months. The river, the Dnipro, is now the front line. The Russians are on the other side, and they're shelling the city more and more. So that's an example of where there's an overlap. But, you know, where you are, wherever you're traveling in an area that's been affected by the war, there's a difference between those areas that have seen occupation and those that haven't. So obviously the biggest stories are in the liberated areas, the areas that have just come out of occupation, where there's, you know, the world needs to know about what it was like there, what the Russians were doing, lots of different aspects of life there. I've got an article coming out soon about a museum that was completely looted in Kherson. It, you know, its whole collection was taken away to Crimea. But then, yeah, even if a place hasn't actually been under occupation, they haven't been ruled by the Russians, you still have areas that have been basically in the war zone for months and months. So back in October, I was in areas near towns called Siversk, Soledar. Maybe right now there's a lot of talk about a city called Bakhmut at the moment, where the Russians are throwing hundreds and hundreds of mobilized troops and artillery, trying to take this one city. It's really hell there. And I wasn't in Bakhmut, but I was in these areas nearby. So that's a different situation, because those towns have not actually been under occupation. The story is not about life under kind of Russian rule. It's about the war itself, and it's about living on that front line for so long. I guess that would be the difference there.
Okay, yeah. And I'm thinking, like, when you were there, for example, in these different areas, when you speak mm-hmm. to people, I'm guessing you interviewed a lot of mm-hmm. different people. And again, is there any difference between, I'm guessing there must be, but any difference when you interview people who have experienced this Russian occupation mm-hmm. now they are liberated, and the people who just have been living, let's say, constantly under Ukrainian control, but experiencing very much this frontline atmosphere and constant attacks from the Russians?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And there is a huge difference. For example, if you talk about Kherson, they had 8 months of occupation. They had a lot to say about what life was like in that world. But what they haven't really seen, they haven't seen much war, actually, compared to some other areas, because the city was taken very quickly by the Russians. And, you know, that was actually where the so-called special operation was actually really successful, crossing the bridge, taking the city very quickly. And the city is still more or less intact. You know, it hasn't suffered from huge shelling from either side. And so it was like, okay, you were in occupation and now you're out. Now you're really happy. But if you compare that to a city like Izyum, for example, which was also under occupation for 6 months, but Izyum was taken by the Russians after a month-long, really brutal battle where they destroyed huge, you know, they caused huge destruction in the city with artillery before they forced the Ukrainians out, and they just walked into the ruins, I guess. Izyum was kind of like a little Mariupol in many ways. And so people's experience there is they weren't like all coming out and celebrating like in Kherson. Some people were, but most people were just like kind of waking up from just a nightmare, basically. And then you have areas like Siversk and Soledar, which were not under occupation, but have been on this front line for so many months. And over there is where you start to hear this phrase I'll translate it, but like basically, it doesn't matter to me who is in power. I just want it to be quiet. And yeah. Obviously, you understand. I mean, these are old people. Maybe they miss the Soviet Union and they don't understand all the context of the war now. And they have been living in a war zone. So it's totally understandable for them to say something like that. But on the other hand, you can tell, like, if you're saying this, then if you're saying that it doesn't matter who's in power, then yeah, it's clear that you haven't been in occupation like some of your fellow Ukrainians, because if you were, you would probably maybe rethink that, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And I'm wondering, so here we talked a bit about the local population, but I'm guessing you might have also had a chance to talk to the soldiers that are on the front lines. And is that a correct assumption?
Yes.
Okay. And so when you talked to them, I mean, how did you manage to interact with them? Did you actually spend some time with them, meaning kind of like staying where they are staying, or would you just come and do an interview with them? And what are your kind of like impressions of them when you interact with them?
In terms of access with soldiers and being able to talk to them, it's maybe people would be surprised to hear that it's very different in different parts of Ukraine. In the south, you know, in the Kherson area before Kherson was liberated, it was very strict. You could not leave the city of Mykolaiv, which would be the base of where you were working. You couldn't leave there without a press officer, and you needed to book a press tour with a certain brigade, a certain unit of soldiers beforehand, and then you could talk to them in these frontline areas just for a few hours, but then you needed to go back. In the east, in the Donbass, it's much more interesting because it's much more free and you can just kind of drive where you want. And if you see some soldiers, you can just start chatting to them. And officially, you know, sometimes they will say, oh, we have rules, we can't speak to the press. But very often they're just very friendly and they will start talking to you, and they'll be quite happy that they have someone to talk to, and they will, you know, show you how their tank works, maybe let you ride on it. So
did you ride on a tank?
Yeah, I did.
Pretty cool. Well, this is really cool, but it would have been cooler if you didn't have to do it because there was no war.
No, it's okay. It was just objectively really cool. But yeah, because of that environment, sometimes you have a very big spectrum of who's willing to talk to you and how much they're willing to talk to you. But overall, I also have a friend who is an artillery commander in the south. So it's always good to chat to him. It's never on the record, and I haven't written an article about him because you would need permission from the higher ups, which they weren't going to give. But he just invites me to the village where they're staying, and we chat a lot. So yeah, I've talked to quite a few. In terms of a general overall kind of impression that I could say, I think the universal kind of constant is that, you know, everyone is optimistic, but everyone is, you know, quite tired. You can see how the work takes a toll on them mentally, and you understand that for many of them, they're not able to go back and see their loved ones as often as they should be able to, because they just they're just needed there. And you do learn quite a lot about how the war is being fought on the ground, on the very front line. Quite often it breaks some maybe stereotypes, or it breaks some ideas that you get if you only read about the war on Twitter. You understand that it is much more complicated and much uglier and much more difficult in real life. But I guess that shouldn't come as a surprise. If there's anything more specific, I guess I can maybe.
Do you have any examples of how it's different that you could reveal, unless it's
secret stuff? I mean, the first thing I would say, for example, is that when we had this big surprise counteroffensive in Kharkiv region, I guess the listeners will mostly know about that, you know, when Ukraine took a lot of territory all at once in the space of a few days, including Izyum, and the Russians were fleeing. It's very easy to, you know, to kind of succumb to this snowball of optimism, thinking, oh my God, like, look at them, they're in such chaos, the Russians. they're falling back, they're running away, the whole defenses is collapsing, you know. It's just a few days from now, and we'll probably be in Lysychansk or Luhansk or Donetsk or something, and this idea that they're collapsing. But in reality, it's unfortunately much, much more complicated than that, because, you know, an offensive army, you know, they cannot go forward forever. And once the defender has a chance to, you know, dig some trenches, some basic fortifications, prepare a little bit, then it doesn't matter what the overall situation is, doesn't matter who has better morale, it doesn't matter, you know, who has better weapons. And unfortunately, attacking a fortified position, it's the same in World War One, same in World War Two. Attacking a fortified position is always difficult. It will always come with losses. People will die, even if it's the start of a great victory. You know, a lot of people will die at the start when you try and attack any position in this war that is prepared. And it's something that we don't really talk about much when we're too focused on just kind of crazy celebrations about how the Russians are falling apart. But we kind of don't really always think as much about the cost of any kind of offensive operation. That's maybe the main thing I would say about my kind of conversations with them.
Yeah, and I think this was actually said in a way from the beginning. I remember that when the Russians were attacking fast and they were making a lot of progress, it was said that while Ukraine might be doing quite well in terms of defending itself, and then later mm-hmm. on, indeed, it showed that it could defend itself very well and it pushed the Russians back, there was always this follow-up that then when it comes to when the time will come for Ukraine to have to be the offensive mm-hmm. army going back and liberating its areas, that's when things are going to get complicated, because then the Russians will be technically the ones defending themselves and they might be better prepared. And like you said, mm-hmm. they might be in fortified areas that are not very easy to reclaim. But no, I think that's important to remember. And you can also see that we in the media, we don't see many information about the losses. We don't see many statistics on the losses on the Ukrainian side. We see a lot in terms of the statistics of the losses on the Russian side. The Ministry of Defense gives regular updates on that, but you don't see very much the statistics about Ukraine. And on the one hand, and I understand, because you don't want to depress people and undermine the morale. But at the end of the day, this will be revealed, or, you know, it is a fact that a lot of soldiers are also dying. And those, for example, who know them or their families, they know as well. And then eventually you will realize the scale also of the losses on the Ukrainian side.
Yeah. And I think it's a good example of that is with Kherson, because it's where you see how much, you know, like in the early days, mistakes that were made when defending, how costly they are later on when you have to retake that territory. Because with Kherson, obviously the Russians crossed the river and they took all this territory on the other side of Ukraine's biggest river. And if Ukraine was just a little bit better prepared, if you didn't have local officials, we still don't know too much about what exactly happened, but if you didn't have local officials kind of betraying the Ukrainian defense in that area, then you could have been a little bit better prepared. You could have blown up those bridges beforehand and never even let the Russians across the river to Kherson. And those little mistakes in the very, very first few days of the war, you can see now, you talk to, for example, medics who were involved in the early stages of the Kherson offensive, and talking about how, you know, the three ambulances that they were in charge of were taking 150 wounded soldiers per day back to the hospital in Mykolaiv. You understand just a little bit the scale of of that cost, which in theory should have been prevented. So it's something that the country will have to come to terms with later on, I think.
I want to ask you a question about something that you actually suggested when we were discussing this interview, but I want to make a disclaimer here for our listeners that this might not be a very pleasant topic, because I want to ask you about torture chambers. So, dear listeners, I will put here a little disclaimer as to which point you should skip this recording if you don't want to hear about this, because this might be quite sensitive content.
Hi, everybody. This is Adam Reichert, currently editing the podcast. I just want to emphasize the disclaimer that Agnieszka put in the beginning of this question. It does include very sensitive content regarding information on the torture chambers that were found in Ukraine. If you do not want to listen to this part, I do suggest just skipping over this question and answer section.
My question is, you brought it up, Francis, when we were talking, that you might want to mention the torture chambers. So would you elaborate on that topic?
Yeah, so these torture chambers were something that we first found out about in September when Ukraine had this counteroffensive and liberated a lot of areas. We heard that the Russians were, taking former veterans, other people with, suspicious tattoos or something. And it was a very widespread system. Almost every village and town had its own kind of basement torture chamber. Bigger cities like Izum had, I think, almost 10, almost 12 maybe. And unsurprisingly, with Kherson, it was the same thing. But I can tell you from my experience being in both areas in the first week after liberation and speaking to a lot of people in all of the areas, the kind of system, and I always say system because it's not just like one or two isolated war crimes where you read, in some international newspaper about the horrors of this Russian torture chamber. It was a system. They existed everywhere. There were several across cities and towns, and this was the way they dealt with any sign of suspicion and resistance in the areas they occupied. And the system in Kherson was more widespread and potentially even more brutal than in Kharkiv. Area. In Izum, for example, which is in Kharkiv Oblast, you talk to people and maybe most of them heard that some people had been taken away, but very few people, well, not very few, but like more rarely did you find someone who actually knew someone who was taken away. But in Kherson, almost everyone you speak to, they can tell you, yep, my father was taken away. My colleague was taken away. My friend was taken away. They were holding them there, I think. They were holding them there. So it was really, really widespread. And just, you could just be talking to someone in a line for humanitarian aid. And someone would bring it up as if it was the most normal thing, that they were held by the Russians for 6 weeks. They were cut with knives, they were electrocuted, they were obviously beaten up brutally. There was another torture method called the elephant, where they would lie down and they would lie you down and they would put a gas mask on you, and then through the tube that came out of the gas mask they would pour water, and someone would just tell you, they did that to me, like it was nothing. Because there was just so many stories. And there was one kid, for example, who was actually helping at the volunteer center, this kind of humanitarian aid center where I was also doing some help. They took me into Kherson, so I was helping a little bit there as well. And there was one kid, he was very smiley. His name was Sergei. And, we just started talking when we're in the line to get coffee, and he just said, "Oh yeah, they held me too for 2 weeks," and he was 18, but he looked like he looked 16. He was a kid still, And then he just started like showing me all these places where they were like cutting him on his belly and stuff. Oh. And it's quite And yeah, I mean, this kind of thing also helps you understand, I guess, why they're so happy now to come out of that nightmare. But that's, I think, the thing that people need to understand the most, that it was systematic, it was widespread. And you know, this was a region, the capital city of an area that they annexed, that they were like, this is Russia now.
Yeah.
They didn't, it's not like Crimea where they made an effort to like pump lots of money in and make everything nice and beautiful. Like there, the locals' experience of Russia was immediately to be thrown into this kind of lawless gangster world where if some drunk guy at a checkpoint doesn't like the look of you, you could disappear for a month and come out, you know, having been tortured in all of these horrible ways.
And then they organize a referendum and they say, oh, 98% of the population is in favor of joining Russian Federation.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked you. Of course, I'm not happy with what I heard, but I think it's important to talk about this and to also understand the scale of this national trauma that we might perhaps not see yet. Because like you say, for now, people seem to have gotten accustomed to it and they talk about it as if it was a normal thing. But let's face it, this is probably just a mask, right? For a lot of people, this is an incredibly traumatic experience that might come back to haunt them for many years to come. And that might come back to the surface at some point. Maybe now they managed to suppress it somehow, but it will come back and potentially hit them even harder in some years or months. So, and so many people have experienced this, right? Either personally or their loved ones experienced it. So this is really, we're going to have a nation after this war, a multi-million nation where half of the nation or most of the nation, I don't know, whatever percentage, is just absolutely traumatized and has been through things that most of us thankfully never experience or never have experienced. But this is something that will need to be addressed as well. But maybe to end on a hopefully positive note, I don't know, let's see what you tell me. When you look at these recent developments and the general mood among the Ukrainian population, what do you expect from the coming weeks and months, both, let's say, in terms of the military campaign and also in terms of what we're saying, people just somehow dealing with winter and with all these conditions? Is there something positive that we can find there?
it's an interesting question, especially with the war itself, how it will go, because we're at a very crucial time now, and it's a time where what's ahead of us is really kind of uncharted territory. The counteroffensive in September was a very pleasant surprise, showing how you know Ukraine can liberate territory like this quickly and hopefully repeat it in the future. But taking back Kherson, it was a matter of time. You know, we knew that Ukraine would take back Kherson. We knew that the Russians were in an impossible position logistically. And while it is a huge victory for Ukraine, it was expected. Now the road ahead is going to be more difficult because the Russians have more troops to defend a smaller front line. And in some places, actually, they still think they can attack with all of these mobilized troops coming in through Bakhmut. So I find it very, very difficult to kind of predict what will happen next, because on the one hand, I agree with many people who say that Ukraine actually has the advantage over the winter because Russia's mobilized troops are still very poorly trained and they have poor morale and poor warm clothing, and Ukrainian troops are generally much better equipped for the winter, and the Ukrainian commanders generally are a lot smarter. But then again, that goes against what I know about how difficult it is to attack, how costly it is, and how the Russians defenses will be stronger now that they've given up on Kherson. So the next, you know, the next big kind of break in the war, the next big action, it's really difficult to predict. But when it comes, it will give us a very good indication of the general trend of which way things are going now. As for the population, again, it's difficult to say. Like, life will get harder and harder. I would not be surprised if there are, you know, more, you know, new waves of refugees choosing to spend winter outside Ukraine. In fact, I think it's actually encouraged. Ukrainians have a good place to stay in Europe somewhere, especially, then to go there to reduce their energy consumption, to have a better standard of living themselves. You know, in cities, I usually have faith that you know they work really hard. I find it incredible the work they do to get, you know, to get the lights turning on as soon as they do after a big attack. My personal worry is for the people that I met in kind of these frontline areas, which haven't had electricity or anything for months and months, and they're now just this kind of cynical, kind of apathetic mindset starts to kick in for many people. Like, I'm home, I'm just gonna stay here no matter what happens. And that can be seen as strong on one hand, but on the other hand, it's dangerous when the temperature goes below freezing point. It will be really tough. If you want something positive, I can obviously say that you know, this will not have an effect on Ukraine's will to fight. It will only strengthen their will to fight, strengthen their resolve to defeat Russia in this war. And I don't think it will really affect, you know, the loss of electricity in big cities. I don't think it will really affect the situation on the front line too much. It's a very professional military, which is independent of that kind of thing. They've got Starlinks and stuff to communicate, and they'll be fine, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I'm not entirely sure if I would say now these days that having Starlinks means that they are independent.
Yeah,
unfortunately, true. I think they are quite dependent on a certain individual. A
certain someone.
Yeah.
But yes, you know, to use the words of many a Russian propagandist, I would say no panic. No panic for now.
Okay, I'll take it. It's a relatively positive message, but I think also definitely one message to everyone out there, and especially decision makers, is that we need to support Ukraine through this winter, and that we cannot forget about what is happening there. And that the fact that, let's say, the most of the strikes target infrastructure and not people doesn't make it any better, because the effect on the population in general is much wider and can be much more disastrous in the long term. So it's worth bearing that in mind. I don't know, Francis, if you have time for a couple more bonus questions.
Yeah, a bit more time.
Yeah. Okay, no worries. Fantastic. Yeah. So we're gonna end this main interview for our listeners, and we're gonna move on to our patron zone and do a couple of bonus questions for our patrons.
And that was Agnieszka's interview with Francis Farrell, who is a reporter and journalist with Kyiv Independent. Thanks to Aga for having this conversation. I hope that you did enjoy it. It touches on some very important topics and issues currently related to the situation in Ukraine. And I think we will be continuing, as I mentioned in the intro to this episode, we will continue our coverage. Later this week, we will have one more episode. So we are actually releasing two episodes this week, which is quite a accomplishment for our podcast. So the second episode is going to look more at the military strategy and what is the current situation on the battlefield whereas this discussion was more related to the civilian situation, which is, I think, also very important and very dire. So, Maciek, I think we can go from there straight into our announcement section.
Yes, as always, we want to share with you a couple of announcements. First of all, this is important for us to stay in touch with our listeners, so you can do it with different ways, which also helps us to develop this podcast. So you can either join our Facebook group, or you can follow us on social media, you can visit our website, leave your comments there. Also on the website, you will find all previous episodes, because the website is actually our archive of the podcast. And also, we want to encourage those of you who like the podcast but who are not our patrons to consider supporting us in that way, because this is also something that we really appreciate, because it helps to develop the podcast, to reach the new audience. So there is a new offer our new benefit for our patrons, which we prepared some weeks ago. This is available for one of the tiers, couple of the tiers of the support. So check out our Patreon profile. All important links you will find in the description of this episode. And Adam, if you don't have any other announcements, I would like to end with our traditional patron shout out.
Sure, that sounds great. Let me just quickly insert myself here into the conversation, just to let everyone know also that the newest issue of New Eastern Europe is coming out next week. So please stay tuned for that. We are looking at different scenarios with Russia in going ahead in the future, what relations could look like between the West, what the situation in Russia could look like in the next several months, a year. And definitely keep your eye out for that. We're a little late on this issue, but we have some really great content, plus an additional special section on Belarus and the current situation there. And of course, Maciek, your article is featured in that issue as well, looking at the Polish support for Ukrainian refugees over the last year.
I forgot about that, Adam.
Yeah.
Thank you for the reminder. Okay, so now, last but not least, our favorite patrons benefit, traditional patron shout out. So I would like to say thank you very much and say hello to all of our patrons, including Luke, Susie, Sean, David, Daniel, Carolina, Percy, RSG, Michael, Anais, Tom, Olaf, Sibi, Klaus, Plummen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Alice, David, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erika, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you all very much.
Wow, what a group of patrons that we have and who are a part of our community. Thank you so much. We are going to be preparing a special event in December before the end of the year. Please stay tuned for that. And it's not only for our patrons, but also for everyone. Stay tuned. We will have an announcement coming very shortly. Maciek, I think that's all we have for today's episode of Talk Eastern Europe. I just want to say thank you all again for joining us. Please do not forget to give us that 5-star rating on the apps. Please don't forget to stay in touch. Drop us a line. We love to hear from you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.